Sister, woman, sister, can you still feel any pain? Or have they robbed you of your anger while putting Thorazina in your vein? Sister, woman, sister, have the walls grown up so high that you can't even dream of leaving and you've forgotten how to fly? Oh, sister, woman, sister.
Hi, I'm Irene Yarrow, and this is Every Woman's Space.
Locked her up in some juvenile hall to grow up weary and wild. Oh, sister, woman, sister.
This program, as many of you know by now, is by, for, and about women. All kinds of women. Lesbian and straight, well-known and not known, of different racial and ethnic groups, from all classes and all ages. It's a place for us to be together, to talk, to learn, and to grow. Tonight the show is on tape. I'm away somewhere. I don't know where yet because I'm taping this in the early part of August and you'll be hearing it probably the last Sunday in August. So I'm afraid there won't be any phone calls this show, but as always, you can write, and I hope you do write, to me, Irene Yarrow, at 359 East 62nd Street. I'd love to hear from you, and so would my guest. This is the third program on women writing, and with me is Alma Rautsung. Hi, Alma.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
She is an author whom you may know as Isabel Miller, because that is the name she used to publish her best-known book, Patience and Sarah, which was incredibly important to me. I read it probably about 6 months after it first came out. At the time, I was a married woman, a straight woman. Did you know this?
No, I didn't know it.
Oh. Well, you were one of the people who was most instrumental in my coming out. I read your book when I was straight, and I used to put on BAI all the time and try to catch lesbian radio shows. And a friend of mine, a straight friend who knew me pretty well, in fact, I think she knew me better than I knew myself at that point, said to me one day very casually, I'm throwing out a lot of books. I'm giving them away.
She was throwing out?
She was clearing her house out. She was cleaning out her house. She wasn't throwing them out. She was looking for someone to give them to. And she
said, she was probably just trying to get it to you without being obvious about it.
It might be. But we had been in a woman writers group together, and she might have known before I was willing to know what was happening. And she said, oh, you might like this. And she gave me this book. And I took it home, and it was a hardcover edition, and it had the picture of the two women on the front,
yeah.
Right? And I took it home, and I put it somewhere, and a few weeks later, I said, oh, right, there's that book, I think I'll look at it, and I started to read it, and it was a love story about two women. And they were women who started to love each other at a time when women, they didn't know any women who did, because it was last century, and they were lesbians then, but they didn't know each other. I mean, there was nothing... that there was no place they could go to meet other lesbians. I think they hadn't even heard of the possibility of women loving each other.
No.
Right.
One of them had read Plato and knew that men did.
Uh-huh. And it was that the story was a very slow and poetic and beautiful and gradual unwinding of their feelings for each other. And it has a very happy ending.
Yeah. And some people hold that against it.
I don't. I don't hold it against it at all. I read it, and I read it absolutely avidly, probably as avidly as I've ever read anything. And then when I got near the end, I started to slow down because I didn't want it to be over.
And then I have to tell you, Irene, when I was writing it, I hoped that would happen.
Oh.
I must admit.
I'm happy to make you happy. It meant an enormous amount to me. Anyway, Patience and Sarah was published in 1972, and it's out right now and available in paperback.
Yeah.
You published that book under the name of Isabel Miller, though your name is Alma Rautsung, and I think that I'd like to start with asking you why.
Well, the reason was that my children were young, and I really look on childhood as the most miserable of all times, and I didn't want to add to their burdens. I think I was probably wrong. Turns out that lesbians can be open with their children and not too many bad things happen to the kids, but mm-hmm. I didn't know that. And my littlest kid hit her majority last January, and I came out. I broke my pseudonym in contemporary authors and so on.
You waited until then to come out publicly?
To come out coast to coast. I've been out for a long time in New York, but mm-hmm. What I did was I when I filled out my questionnaire for contemporary authors, I put Isabel Miller in, and it said "See Elma Rout Song," and there it was. And you'd be amazed how many people see that. You'd think nobody ever looks in contemporary authors, but they do.
Before you wrote Patience and Sarah, you wrote other books, and we were just talking earlier about what happened. They were published, and your publisher loved them.
Yeah. This was two novels. I wrote the first one when I was 26, and Houghton Mifflin published it. And Houghton Mifflin also published the second one, and they claimed that they really believed in me and that I was this very promising person.
I like the phrase you used earlier.
What?
Young Willa Cather.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was told that my editor gestured toward Olympus when she spoke of me. And then, good grief, I grew up. I never know whether I grow up or ungrow, but I changed. And I started my third novel, which was sort of my own homegrown feminism. I think the feminist movement had not begun. You know, it died down after we got the vote, and then there wasn't anything to speak of for a while. I was out in Illinois and thinking about all these things and very much disapproved of it. You'd be amazed how hard it is to be a feminist by yourself.
Were there other women that you talked to about your
feelings?
Yes, I
did, but they all disagreed. Every single one disagreed.
Did you live in a suburban community?
No, I lived in a university town. A lot of bright people lived in Urbana. Good women, you know, just fine.
But no one had feminist feelings.
No, or they wouldn't tell me if they did. It often turns out that people have been agreeing with you all along but didn't tell you.
I remember a friend that I had when I was 15 who was reading Simone de Beauvoir, The Second Sex.
Yeah.
And I would disagree with her. She was reading the book and she was very excited and she had a lot of very, very feminist feelings and growing strength. Like her mother and her sisters were nurses and she wanted to be a doctor, and she talked a lot about how hard that was going to be, and she felt, you know, all of the things about how much harder it is for women to achieve than men, and got into reading this book and talked to me a lot about it, and I just completely disagreed with her. I'm a little surprised that I couldn't have heard her.
Yeah. Anyway, this that I'm going to read is part of the feminist novel that made Houghton Mifflin give up on me. They would not publish it.
Was this after you'd written the whole thing?
No, I was never able to finish it. I have about 120 pages.
What did you do when you stopped writing it? Did you start something else or go into a...
Then I decided I didn't want to write any more about straight people, and I wanted to write about lesbians.
Uh-huh.
And
this isn't about lesbians. This is about a woman with an emerging feminist consciousness?
No, she has zero consciousness.
Uh-huh.
This is very ironic.
Uh-huh.
This is my little sarcastic stage. Everything in it is wrong. It is backwards. Her opinions are all 100% incorrect.
But Houghton Mifflin picked up on the sarcasm.
Oh, yes, they did.
They didn't like it.
No, they didn't like it.
Why don't you read it? And then
okay.
We have a lot to talk about after
yeah,
you read
all
it.
Right.
What was the book called?
Gertrude. It was just the working title. When Gertrude was 21, she and Earl ran a little grocery down south in Pectoral, Florida. They had three babies and another on the way, and Gertrude was a baby, too, in her heart. Although in her body, she felt very old. So tired all the time, legs aching, bones aching, breasts like boils, so tender. And even though they had a colored lady named Julia to do the diaper washing and all that, there was still a lot for Gertrude to do with so many young children. And when she didn't feel good, it was so hard. What made it even harder was making so many mistakes at the store that even patient Earl couldn't help getting cross with her. And on top of that, she was lonesome and friendless. Living in Pectoral was like being a new kid in a school where everybody knows everybody else and doesn't need you for a friend. Gertrude wasn't used to having friends exactly, but she was used to having people around who were a little bit pleasant. The Pectoral people treated Earl and Gertrude like an army of occupation, like foreclosers on widows and orphans. Earl said he didn't mind, that the ignorant crackers meant nothing whatever to him. So Gertrude tried and tried not to mind either, but she couldn't help herself. Oh, the long days at the store. Earl said she shouldn't mind. There was, after all, no business to speak of. What was so hard about just being there? And oh, the long nights when Earl was away, as he so often was, trying to find business opportunities, trying to better himself, and never getting discouraged or believing that it was impossible for a northerner to better himself in Florida as it was in those days. A lesser man would have given up, but Earl was out night after night after night looking for opportunities. She admired him for it and tried not to mind being alone. But sometimes when the children were asleep at last and the house was quiet, in spite of knowing better, she felt lonesome. She even missed, of all people, her mother and all the little brothers and sisters, and had to keep reminding herself that when she was with them, she didn't really like them much. And she felt also on those lonely nights warm, or as Earl in his funny way said it, horny. Earl said she didn't understand, that like all women she was forever cut off from understanding, though it should have been plain enough, that in surrendering to the lusts of women, men actually lost a part of themselves, an actual physical substance was taken away from them, while women didn't have to give anything at all, but only take. She could understand that. Of course she could. He was always a gentleman, and he never said it was selfish of her to want so much, but she could see it for herself, and she tried to learn to wait. She certainly was a selfish brat there for a while, and Julia only made her worse. But of course, Gertrude didn't realize that at first. All she thought about at first was that she was lonesome and needed kindness. Plenty of people never do get over thinking about what they personally need, and she was no better than the rest at that time. Yes, she selfishly thought only of her own need for kindness, and Julia, in her way, seemed kind for a while. She was never very prompt, Julia. She'd come strolling in late half the time, and that would make Gertrude late opening the store. But luckily, Earl slept later and didn't know about that. There'd come Julia strolling half an hour late. Sometimes she'd bring her own children with her, and the house would end up messier instead of better, and Gertrude would have to clean it herself after she got home from the store, so Earl wouldn't find out and make her fire Julia. She just didn't want to fire Julia. There was just something comfortable about her, and the babies loved her. She never seemed to be working, always rocking somebody, but somehow the housework usually got done. As that fourth pregnancy went along, Gertrude felt worse and worse. All the bones in her pelvis seemed to come apart. In fact, according to the doctor, they did loosen up. They were supposed to. But are they supposed to feel like they've been run over with a truck? She asked, and he laughed. He thought she was witty, and she was so pleased about that that she didn't realize until she got home that he hadn't answered. But the fact was she could feel, and practically even hear, her pelvic bones grinding against each other when she walked, and nobody would believe it except Julia. And there were two spots of pain low in Gertrude's belly, like ruptures, that went away only if she stayed very quiet on her back with a pillow under her knees. If she got tired, which got to be almost always, the spots of pain would join together and form a big wide blade of pain all the way across her. At first she just went ahead and worked no matter what, but later, beginning at about the seventh month, she gave up. She told herself she couldn't open the store, if she had to be whipped or killed for not, and she stayed in bed. Earl couldn't understand. He didn't like her behavior one bit. She was puzzled, too. The other pregnancies hadn't been like that. She'd always felt all right before. And here she was with the fourth one, having such a strangely hard time, her legs swollen, her ankles puffing out over her shoe tops, back aching, belly splitting. She couldn't blame Earl for thinking she was trying to put one over on him. Everybody knew that having babies got easier and easier, and that the Chinese women worked in the fields up until the last minute and then went over behind a rice bush and popped the baby out like a puppy or a calf and cut the cord themselves, and that was that, back to work. Gertrude felt so guilty for not being woman enough, and she tried and tried, but for the last 2 months she just couldn't anymore. with the best intentions in the world, she just couldn't. And poor Earl had to open the store. He hated it so. He wasn't meant for things like that. Dad Sunup never should have expected him to do it. So Earl opened the store, and Gertrude stayed in bed, dozing and dreaming, listening to Julia putter around the house. It was peaceful. You'd feel better if you'd get up and around, everybody said. And sometimes Gertrude would try, but it didn't work. She felt worse. She felt best staying in bed. Even Julia told her to get up sometimes, because Julia was more like the Chinese women and couldn't really understand either how Gertrude felt. The doctor told her. Earl told her. She didn't mind that, because how could a man understand? But when Julia told her, she couldn't help it. She cried. You just bring it on yourself, Miss Sunup, Julia said. And Gertrude's heart broke, and she didn't know why or what to do or how to hide it. And she turned her face so Julia wouldn't see and held her breath and tried to control herself. But she didn't have any strength anymore. She couldn't stand turning face down with the baby so big, so the only way she could hide was to grab Earl's pillow and cover her face with it. She took a big bite, a big mouthful of the pillow, and sobbed away quietly. And then there was Julia lifting the pillow away and gathering her up and saying, "Don't, honey, don't." And every morning after that, when Earl was gone and the children were busy in the sandbox or somewhere, Julia would come in and make much of Gertrude a little, tuck her hair behind her ears, give her a hug, say, "How my two babies this morning," meaning Gertrude and the baby inside. Then Julia would sit on the corner of the bed by Gertrude's feet and tell her news. It didn't have to be world-shaking news. It didn't even have to be interesting. For instance, Julia told her a lot about flowers, which ones were budded, which were blossoming. And Gertrude at that time didn't care one single bit about flowers. But she racked her brain for questions so she could keep Julia sitting there, telling her. One day Julia brought some thread and a crochet hook. "You just go out of your mind, you don't get something to do," she said. Gertrude was all thumbs at first, learning to crochet, but Julia was patient with her. "You're doing just fine, honey baby, just fine." And her beautiful pink-palmed brown hands would take the thread and hook again. "Now watch, see here, watch, honey, you almost got it. Just watch how I do this part." The warmth of Julia, the smell of her. No wonder Gertrude was all thumbs. Smell of leather, sweat, pomade, perfume. Smell like hands that have been committing that sin that God despises. Smell of food and baby powder and sun-warmed attics. Gertrude didn't like Julia's smell, and then she liked it. But liking or disliking, she couldn't pay close attention to learning to crochet. But she did learn, of course. Anybody could that wanted to. And pretty soon she was making so many beautiful things, doilies, potholders, headrests for the chairs, openwork sweaters for the children to wear on coolish mornings. Such happy days, peaceful in bed, crocheting, listening to Julia sweep or sing or rock the babies at nap time. Creak, creak went the rocking chair until the babies were all asleep, and Gertrude was too. That's how little it took to make her happy. Maybe, she thought, maybe I'm not unhappy by nature after all, when 15 minutes a day of having someone baby me can make me so happy. What she didn't know then was that we are not born to be happy, but to do our duty. She shirked her duties every one and went aching after happiness, which to a baby like herself at 21 meant being babied. If only Earl would baby her. If only Earl would give her that 15 minutes a day. She didn't really want it from Julia. She wanted it from Earl. She hoped he'd notice the change in her and ask about the cause. But of course, he had more important things to do than study out every little thing about her moods. It was childish of her to expect it. She realized she'd have to mention it herself. And after a while, she found the chance. It was evening. The children were playing in the long after-supper twilight. Gertrude was on the bed resting, gathering strength to put the children to bed. Earl was in the bedroom putting on a clean shirt, getting ready to go out. The first shirt he took was all right, no buttons missing, no wrinkles ironed in, so he wasn't forced to lose his temper. The moment seemed perfect for talking about happiness. "Earl, honey?" "Talk to me?" there's nothing to say. Call me baby. Baby? Not like that. Say it like Julia does. Say, how my baby today? For God's sake, what are you two up to? Why, nothing. She gives me a little hug and calls me baby. And that's nothing? Foolishly, she tried to bluff. What's wrong with that? What's wrong? If I said Cooper gave me a little hug and called me baby. Earl's voice went way up high, and he wet his finger and smoothed his eyebrow down. You'd know damn good and well what's wrong with that. But nothing. You think just because you're a woman you can get away with anything. But women don't, do they? Oh, don't they? She felt shame so horrible. Such waves and waves of horror and shame. Oh, rocks, hide me. Oh, earth, open and swallow me. Oh, death, accept me. Unbearably, he kept talking, standing beside the bed, tall above her, jingling his keys in his pocket, talking nicely, without anger. I don't care if you take a lover, but pay me the compliment of taking a man, white if possible. Oh, no, no, I only love you. And treat your next servant like a servant. You know, it's not necessary to have everybody like you. I suppose you have a natural sympathy for the servant classes, but do me the compliment of remembering you're a son up now. He was as unpitying as a baby being born. Her sobs didn't make him stop. He was so right, and she knew it. She only wished he'd see that he'd said enough, that she understood, that she would end all that, that it was ended already. The thought of Julia made her sick. Earl didn't have to say what she now saw for herself, that Julia was using her, hunting her up to get out of doing a good job, and then undoubtedly going back to her people and laughing. Gertrude didn't doubt for a second that Julia was saying, just hug Miss Sunup and she don't care if you sweep the floor or not. Gertrude didn't need Earl to tell her, but he wouldn't stop telling her, and he said that she was just trying to pull a fast one on him, staying in bed, playing sick. You're just trying to make a chronic invalid out of yourself. You have to learn to do what you're supposed to, whether you feel like it or not. Do you think I go to that damn store every day because I want to? I do my part, and I want you to do yours. Yes, Earl. Will you fire her, or will I? I will. And Gertrude did the very next morning. It was one of the hardest things she ever did. She couldn't have done it except that she hated the sight of Julia, and the hatred made her feel strong enough to work and work forever, alone, to death. I'm much stronger now, and I won't need you after today, she said. She couldn't quite forget just yet what Julia had seemed for a while to mean, and that's why she said it that way instead of the way her better self knew she should. You're lazy and immoral, and get out. Julia was certainly surprised. She didn't say anything for a minute, and then she said, okay, and went sauntering off, leaving a tub full of diapers. Gertrude had no washing machine, because while Julia did the washing, it wasn't necessary. Gertrude cried, but Julia was gone by then and didn't know. Gertrude stood over the tub and scrubbed the diapers on the scrub board and rinsed them with her tears. Earl was right. She wasn't as sick as she thought. If she kept one hand pushed hard against the pain, she could do everything she was supposed to. Her skin didn't split and let her insides pour out. It was all just her imagination that it was going to. Maybe her work took a lot longer than if she'd had two hands free, but what did she need to save time for? She couldn't chase the children, but she solved that problem too by shutting them in one room and not caring how messy they made it during the day and then cleaning it after they were asleep. It was not easy, and yet there was a satisfaction in that struggle to grow up. Earl was right. You can do what you know you have to. Earl certainly made a woman of her. She was grateful. Anything's hard until you face up to it. It got to be a point of pride with Gertrude, not to give in no matter how she felt. She wouldn't care to be soft and self-indulgent like other women. They didn't even deserve the name of women, because they couldn't do what Gertrude could. And she couldn't have done it either if it hadn't been for Earl. God bless Earl.
You're gonna stop.
Yeah.
Not only do I not want you to stop, I don't want you to have stopped writing that book.
Yeah. Oh. I keep thinking I ought to finish it.
I think you ought to finish it. One thing I always I'm interested in as a writer is, this is now several years ago.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it now?
I would have cleaned it up a little, I think. Mm-hmm. There are places where it's a little fancy.
I have to confess, I couldn't hear them. I heard it in one place. I can't remember. It was about a page ago where something went a little bit too far. But
yes.
It was one line. Yeah. But anyway, what does that matter? I mean, cleaning up is a matter of sort of technical skill. But what it is in us that makes us able to write things like this, it doesn't have to do with our technical skill as a writer. I think it has to do with what we feel inside. And it's just lucky that we happen to be able to write and that we're good with words. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what that says is important, and it's still important now. And even though the women's movement is now developed, and hopefully still developing, and it's not before it like it was when you wrote that, it's still important. And there are still many, many, many women who haven't been touched by the women's movement yet and who would need to read that, and why isn't it finished? Especially that kind of consciousness raising that comes from going into the life of a woman like Gertrude and seeing things through her eyes and seeing what it was like, what it's like living with Earl, and what it was like getting to know a woman like Julia who could give and who could be nurturing.
Yeah.
And what it was like to be defeated, completely defeated, just like at the beginning of the movement when people would say dyke, would say lesbian to
right.
us, we would go shrink up and go back in our little shells. And
yeah.
that's what she did. He just said that. And she said,
yeah.
But women don't. And he said, oh, don't they? And you really got the characters down incredibly well. He's so horrible, I want to kill him.
As I planned the book, she was going to kill him.
What?
She gets a job in a factory and makes some money. And the thesis of the book was going to be, if you want to keep a woman a slave, don't let her have money of her own. Because the moment she had money of her own, her consciousness rose, and she began reinterpreting all the events of her life. And Earl's a big drinker. In fact, I think he's an alcoholic. And he's going to get ulcers, and she's going to kill him by refusing to cook his ulcer diet for him. And since he has no willpower and no character, she can tempt him with all these bad foods, and he will die. That was my plan.
You know what I'm sitting here wondering is whether this would be publishable now by a commercial publisher. Now, why not? Because this is no longer something
I know,
people
now,
are scared of.
All of a sudden, it's old-fashioned. It was ahead of its time, and now it's rather behind
its time. It was ahead
of
its time, right, but it's not old-fashioned. I really don't feel it is. I feel that this kind of thing is still very, very necessary. You writing this had a consciousness.
Yeah.
Gertrude didn't have one. Gertrude had the feelings and the experience of being a female in a marriage where she didn't get
anything.
A friend. I mean, she was married to someone who wasn't her friend.
Yeah.
And all she really wanted was a friend, a loving friend. And her husband couldn't be that to her.
Actually, I wouldn't want to leave it at that. She needed a woman. Her husband, even if he had wanted to, couldn't have been what she needed. You know, that it was rejected by a lot of people. My agent tried to get an advance for me from a lot of other publishers when Houghton Mifflin wouldn't take it. They said things like, you know, I mean, it's too harsh. Things aren't really like that. This sort of vaguely touches on something I've been thinking about a lot, and this is about the belief of the great middle, let us say. I don't know what to call people, housewives and people like that, who think that feminists and lesbians don't understand them and don't like them and hold them in contempt, and that's why they wouldn't vote for equal rights amendments, stuff like that. And I sort of feel this need to be more understanding and more loving toward straight women who are trying to pull off this incredible, difficult thing they've undertaken.
I think far from us as feminists and lesbians not liking women like that, I think that it's men who don't. I think it's the straight world who don't. And I think that we have a very strong and growing appreciation and respect for what it is to be a woman in a household with children and having to do all that, and an understanding of how much you have to go without in terms of the richness of your life and the richness of your emotional life.
I think that's come out of consciousness raising groups, that in our efforts to understand our mothers, we've come to have a lot more respect for the pain and difficulty of that life,
mm-hmm.
and the real heroism it takes to live it. But I know that when I looked straight, I would sometimes see lesbians like in the grocery or something, and they would look past me like I was a can of beans, you know. No identification with me at all.
Hmm. But that's like assuming that all lesbians, for example, aren't mothers and weren't married.
Yeah.
Whereas I was a married woman who became a lesbian, and the number of lesbian mothers, oh goodness, what was someone estimated it at a recent thing?
It was about a third, I think.
One third of all lesbians are mothers.
Yeah.
And have been, and many continue to, though without the father in the home, continue to live that life of bringing up children, of being poor, of having to survive on demeaning, depersonalizing jobs or else on welfare. And other government subsidies that are so inadequate and make you feel so horrible. And we're that too.
Yeah. I remember once some women from DOB, Daughters of Bilitis, and I went up to this shrink outfit named William Allenson White Institute because they were having a little speech about lesbianism.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking about how sick we were, basically, and we quarreled with them about that. A little timidly. This was a long time ago.
Huh.
We wouldn't be quite that timid now. But anyway, one of the shrinks, this very pompous man, said that he believed in social disapproval of lesbianism because it made a young woman struggle harder. That she would really, really try if she knew she was going to fall into this terrible condition, you know, that every man's hand would be against her.
Mm.
So that would give her a little extra motivation to try to pull herself together and be straight.
Mm.
And he had very good luck with it. And I